Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
We welcome you to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling for Leighton Behind the Scenes. Coming up on today's episode, our interview guest is Stefan Reed. Stefan is the SVP of Engagements and Strategy Practice Lead at Jackman. He's going to discuss their ongoing human insights study. So we're not only going to talk about how consumers believe they will spend funds, but rather other motivations causing them to perhaps spend or not spend, as the case may be, and why understanding human behaviors, emotions, and motivations is so important for retailers as they try to target a certain demographic within their customer base. In news, it was a big week for earnings calls, but we'll focus on Walmart and the home improvement industry throughout the course of the show. A reminder that you can like us and rate us if you enjoy the podcast on any podcast delivery service. So whether you're listening on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, those ratings do help others to check us out. Also, you can see us on social media at Retail Podcast on both Twitter and Instagram. On Instagram this week, Leighton uploaded a picture of what might be the most scenic Walmart store in the U.S. Is it? Well, you'll have to see for yourself. And a big thanks also to show partner this week, Quantum Metric, whom we'll talk about a little bit later on. But let's start with Walmart. Covered a wide variety of topics on their earnings call this week. And to this point, Walmart's been plugging along during the pandemic. They haven't seen the large swings that have characterized some of their competition, particularly in the grocery space, where we've already started to see comps dip negative for certain retailers as they lap the panic buying from last March and April. Some analysts, you know, have expressed concern at single-digit versus maybe double-digit increases in grocery sales or general merchandise sales, but Walmart hasn't seen the type of flagging sales that have characterized other grocers' lapping of comps that we talked about from that early panic buying surge. And instead, it's more slow and steady for Walmart as they increase market share. And that was a big headline for them. This latest quarter is talking about increasing that market share for them in the grocery sector. Now, e-commerce also has been an area of growth for Walmart. Coming into this quarter, the company has been increasingly bullish on curbside over the last 2 years, as well as just about anyone who's been to a Walmart knows. Would we see more of the same in e-commerce growth, or would brick and mortar take back some internal sales share for the retail giant? Well, let's get to the numbers and find out. For one, they didn't see any easing of sales at all. U.S. comp sales for their second quarter grew by 5.2%, which puts them at a comfortable 14.5% increase on a two-year stack basis. So that's better than many grocers out there, but also roughly in line with other general merchandisers. They did note that they grew their market share in grocery, as I talked about just a second ago. That was a big topic on the call, and they said that is continued so far in the third quarter. And that's also something just from looking at the numbers that we can assume. Given the comp numbers from grocers thus far, mostly negative for this latest quarter during roughly the same period, specifically for Walmart grocery was up mid-single digits for them. They don't break out specific numbers, but mid-single digits for comps, that's pretty good when you consider the months that they're lapping from last year. Transaction growth also for Walmart as a whole in the U.S. was something seen this quarter and something we also expected as people made more frequent trips versus earlier in the pandemic. Transactions were up 6.1%, though basket size did take a mild hit, down about 0.8%. So more people coming to the store on a more frequent basis, just not buying as much while we're there by a slim margin. Now, as far as that e-commerce growth is concerned, it did flag somewhat, as it has for many retailers. E-commerce growth quarter over last year's second quarter was up 6% in the U.S., slightly above their comp growth as a whole, but it's no longer fueling the vast amount of comp growth as it has for the past few years. By the way, on a two-year stack, e-commerce up 103% for Walmart. Specifically, CEO Doug McMillon said during the call itself that sometime during the second quarter, there was actually a shift as some of their online customers went back to shopping brick and mortar rather than shopping exclusively online. So this drove a larger increase in brick and mortar traffic while eating away at some of that robust e-commerce growth everyone has come to expect. Now, whether it's because people are more comfortable getting out and going to the store because of the shape that the pandemic was in a couple of months ago, or whether it's, as Stefan Reed will speak to a little bit later on, people are just wanting to get back to the store to shop, we don't know. And based on what Walmart said during the call, they're not 100% certain either, but it is something to watch for retailers in general, because more and more data that we're getting regarding human behavior and shopping behavior suggests that people want to get out and go to the store, that maybe some of these gains captured by e-commerce companies won't continue for much longer. But again, it's kind of a wait and see in that particular area. By the way, Walmart, like Kroger, has been increasing their non-traditional revenue streams as well. Advertising revenue for Walmart nearly doubled this last quarter in the U.S. And for Walmart, it's not only advertising, but much like Amazon, they leverage their fulfillment and proprietary software to generate some non-traditional revenue as well. Other businesses seem pretty interested in using both, so they've seen revenue go up in all of those categories. And then as far as Sam's Club is concerned, really, if Leighton were on the show, that's all he would be talking about is Sam's Club's quarter. They continue their impressive turnaround. And before you say, Trent, I don't know that this is a turnaround. Remember, just a couple of years ago, Sam's was really struggling in terms of comps. They were closing locations. Well, now you look, comps were up 7.7% against a very solid second quarter of 2021. We should note that Walmart keeps their fiscal year about 1 year ahead of where it is on the calendar. E-commerce sales for Sam's Club up 27% in this quarter. Membership income also saw a big boost, rising 12.2% amidst, get this, a now record number of total members in their queue. Both transactions and ticket were up for Sam's. Transactions up 5.1% and ticket was up 2.5%. And grocery, finally, was a big driver for comps, leading the way. You had double-digit growth in grocery for Sam's Club, which again is very notable considering grocery sales trends we've been seeing over the past 4 months as companies lap their sales from last year. Tobacco, of course, for Sam's continued to be a bit of a drag on those comps. And McMillan, who, by the way, remember, started as an executive in Sam's Club, said that in 19 years, he can't remember when Sam's has had this much momentum. And again, a far cry from when they were basically just voluntarily giving up markets by closing stores in those markets a few years ago. Seattle's market certainly comes to mind in that regard. And finally, bottom line-wise, for the entire company, Walmart, Sam's, and all their international operations, their operating income increased 12% on an adjusted basis. Unadjusted, the increase actually would have been over 20%, and this resulted in adjusted earnings per share of $1.78. That beat Zacks' consensus estimates by around 14%. Analysts expected about $1.56 per share. So good news on the bottom line as well for Walmart. All of these numbers, by the way, resulted in guidance being moved upward. Expectations now for comp sales are now at 5 to 6% for the year at Walmart for the fiscal year, that is, and 7.5 to 8.5% at Sam's. Comp increases there. Both previously were expected to come in at low single digits. So now looking inside their call, I wanted to kind of rapid fire a few key things at you, because you don't want to listen to me just talk about Walmart all day long, and we do have an interview guest to get to. But first, they continue to tackle out of stocks more effectively as we get deeper into the pandemic. Inventories across the company rising 16.2% year over year. John Furner, who is the president and CEO of Walmart US, noted during the analyst Q&A part of the call that this was absolutely needed due to high rates of sell-throughs they're seeing with certain staple products. Inflation, by the way, after he was pressed about it, is low single digits, but that continues to be manageable through multiple means, whether that means working with suppliers, placing large orders, anticipating inflation, or passing through costs. They're using all of those levers to try and manage inflation. Still seeing low single digits for them, so not that 5 to 6% inflation that some have talked about in the media. However, out of stocks are still high in some general merchandise areas due to long shipping lead times. So even a company as large as Walmart is experiencing that supply chain crunch. Now, second, we mentioned groceries' notable comp increase for both Walmart and Sam's Club. Health and wellness was a big comp driver for them as well. This had more to do with the reopening of vision centers and vaccine administration than anything, of course, so that's revenue they weren't getting last year. But also, they rolled out a new private label insulin that is tabbed to save customers about 75% over name brand insulin. And Doug McMillon and the rest of the company feels as though this is going to be a big driver of comps as well going forward in the health and wellness category. The third thing, they saw positive growth in apparel sales and travel-related sales. But at the same time, general merchandise just saw low single-digit increases on a comp basis. This also came despite the fact that last year's auto care center closures were being lapped. So they basically had all this auto care revenue coming in this quarter that they didn't in last year's quarter. Apparel sales, travel sales going up. Yet, general merchandise still kind of on the lower end of their comps in the store. So the middle of their store, if you will, if you think about a supercenter, seems to be struggling a bit, comped out negative in most categories. Out of stocks here, of course, are not helping. And this is an area where John Furner said out of stocks are still burning them, even despite the fact that they've managed to increase inventory by 20% in the U.S. or around 20% in the U.S. specifically. The fourth thing, you know, Sam's really, really positive in the quarter for Sam's. As you look at their category breakdowns, all categories for them comped positive when you take into account the change in their mobile phone business. They basically outsourced their mobile phone business, so they're taking commissions rather than reporting sales. So obviously that affected the comps there. Otherwise, their technology, office, and entertainment category would have been positive, as it was because of the outsourcing of the business that turned negative. Grocery and beverage, as well as fresh, freezer, and cooler, all saw double-digit gains. Home as well continues to be a strong category, and here it is, 18 months into the pandemic, or close to 18 months into the pandemic, we are still talking about that nesting phenomenon, but home rose double digits as well, driven by furniture in particular. The fifth thing I'll note from the call and the final bullet point here is that although back to school didn't really play into this quarter's results, company leadership did provide a preview of back to school and noted that things have been comping well versus back to school sales of the calendar year 2020, something that many people have expected with more school supplies being purchased and less learning from home. Although you would think that there's some trade-off there with some of the technology sales that went on last year to facilitate learning from home. Either way, CFO Brett Biggs said that so far the third quarter is comping out actually a little above the second quarter. It's comping out around 6 to 7% in the positive without fuel impacts in the U.S., due in part to strength in back to school and also more grocery market share gains. I think to summarize this earnings call for Walmart, things looking really solid for them as they have continued to take that slow and steady approach. Is e-commerce growing as it has in previous quarters? No, but that's been somewhat expected. The important thing is, just because e-commerce isn't growing doesn't mean sales aren't growing, and they continue to see traffic coming into the stores, continue to see an increase in traffic and an increase in overall sales, both in Walmart stores in the U.S. and in Sam's Club stores in the U.S. Really, the turnaround at Sam's has been quite remarkable, and I think probably if you're looking at a headline story from this earnings call, that would be it for me. Well, coming up after this break, we'll be joined by Stefan Reed once again of Jackman. He's going to discuss their Human Insights study, a number of things regarding not only consumer behavior, but what's fueling that consumer behavior. He's also going to talk about a few interesting case studies regarding how businesses are using this intelligence, using this data to make informed decisions about attracting certain customers into their store. I think you're going to find it interesting. He talks about, among other retailers, Staples and JOANN. Based on the podcast feedback I get week after week, I know there are a lot of leaders at retail companies out there that listen, and I want to speak specifically to the digital leaders out there. You know, how would it feel to not only know what your customer is experiencing, but how many other customers are experiencing the same thing? I think it's time we start listening to that silent majority of customers and get ahead with real-time insights way before a code freeze. You know, Walmart talked about it on their earnings call. All these other retailers have talked about it. But basically, prep for the holiday season is already underway. Products have been ordered. Plans are in place. And 2021 holiday e-commerce sales are expected to exceed 2020 benchmarks. You need to be prepared to capture every customer revenue opportunity out there in e-commerce. And with Quantum Metric, you can be. Their unique approach to the digital customer experience helps today's top retailers and e-commerce brands. I'm talking Tractor Supply Company, I'm talking JOANN, I'm talking Bass Pro Shops, quickly identify and prioritize both big and small revenue opportunities that keep customers engaged and coming back. And if retailers like the ones I mentioned are using Quantum Metric, why shouldn't your retailer do the same thing? You should head into the holiday season, keep on that nice list that Santa's got by reducing customer friction, increasing conversions, and personalizing the shopping experience. If you want a sneak peek, you can visit them at quantummetric.com/podoffer. That's all one word, quantummetric.com/podoffer, and see if you qualify to receive their 12 Days of Insights offer with the code RETAILFOCUS, all one word. This offer gives you 12-day access to their platform, coupled with a bespoke insight report that will help you identify where customers are struggling or where they're engaging in your digital product. Restrictions do apply. Once again, that website, quantummetric.com/podoffer. Use the code RETAILFOCUS to see if you qualify to receive their 12 Days of Insights offer. The link is in the show notes. Often on the show, we discuss data, and usually this data is related to shopping trends, how much consumers expect they will shop, how they will pay, and on what they plan to spend. However, there's a larger question, and that what drives the decisions for consumers? What is truly at the core of what guides today's customer through the retail landscape? For that, we need to dig a little bit deeper for data about, well, the humans themselves. And to that end, we're pleased to be joined by Stefan Reed, the Senior Vice President of Engagements and Strategy Practice Lead at Jackman, to discuss their ongoing Human Insights study. Jackman, by the way, is a customer engagement reinvention company. Stefan will speak to a little bit of their work here in a second, with an emphasis on North America specifically. Stefan, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Trent.
First, just so our listeners know the perspective that you bring, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what Jackman does on the day-to-day.
Well, we like to describe ourselves as being relentlessly focused on actionable human insights and bringing that to our partners who span retail as well as B2B, hospitality, and beyond. And what that really means in practice is we are expert in getting under the hood of what makes customers tick and what businesses can do to engage with those customers to basically encourage them and invite them to participate and transact more. So our work spans, you know, the traditional type of customer research that many firms will do, but then we take that into a very deep strategy process and planning process. And then what I find particularly satisfying in our work is we actually get the great pleasure of bringing that to life through new store designs, new digital experiences, and so on. So we are a soup to nuts customer engagement reinvention company.
And we'll get to the Human Insights study in just a moment. But first, you know, especially given the context that you just provided us about Jackman, I wanted to ask just a question about why it's important, in your opinion, for retailers to have a truly holistic view of the customer in 2021, not just with shopping habits and what they're going to be spending money on, but with everything else going on in their lives, personal changes, priority shifts, and so forth.
Yeah, and you referenced this off the top, right? That you see a lot of manifest behaviors in the world, and businesses, I think, are quite good at getting data and understanding how consumers are behaving or who those consumers are demographically. But if you're making choices about how am I going to serve a customer in the future, how should my business evolve to stay relevant, you need to get under the hood a little bit and understand the attitudes that are actually driving those behaviors, which can get quite complex. You know, there are some real challenges with traditional ways of that we see businesses doing segmentation. You know, in the world of demographics, you know, I could take somebody like a Joe Biden or an Alice Cooper, who on paper in the demographic world look very similar, but, you know, clearly they've made some very different life choices and have very different preferences and probably attitudes underlying that. You know, similarly with behaviors, you know, it's hard to tell how much of that is driven by, look, those were just my options versus this is how I would ultimately really want to behave. And so if you don't understand the attitudes, you don't understand if there's something that you might be able to offer that customer that might encourage them to behave in a different way that would be more beneficial to your business and provide a better outcome and experience to the customer. So for us, it's really about, you know, it's not about throwing out the demographic profiling or understanding the behaviors, but it's about adding this third leg to the stool that gives us real insight into how the very real human attitudes are guiding the behaviors that manifest in the market.
I think that's a really great point you make about customers sometimes given option A through D, but they would gladly pick E if it were out there, and you don't really know about that unless you know about the whole consumer. And to that end, you know, of course, you did this human insight study there at Jackman. It looked at consumer behavior as it stands in 2021. I know you have 2020 data as well. Very briefly, I was wondering if you mind discussing the overall goal of the study and then who was surveyed as well.
Yeah, for us, it served two purposes. The first was obviously, you know, it's incredibly relevant in our work to be able to speak to the changes that are happening in consumer attitudes. And I think, you know, no surprise to anybody listening that the pace of change in those attitudes, the forces at play that are coming at consumers that are going to influence how they choose what brands and businesses to transact with and what experiences are going to be most relevant, that, you know, there's been a lot of change there and a lot of noise in the press too. So we wanted to cut through a lot of that so that we were able to speak to our clients and engagement partners about what we think is really going to matter to the consumers as they move through the pandemic. And then secondly, you know, for our own purposes, we're also at Jackman always looking for what's around the corner so that we understand what industries we should be talking to today. Because, you know, our bread and butter has always been retail, but because of the work that we do getting under the hood of how consumers and customers behave, that's allowed us, I think, a little bit of an advantage as we look to how do we grow our own business by understanding where the biggest shifts are going to happen. So that was the impetus behind the study. As you mentioned, we did launch that in 2020. We've been running it roughly quarterly. And so we're able to track changes over time. And we've seen some of the attitudes that made a big shift at the beginning have started to trend back, but others have stayed, and I call them sort of, you know, a pretty permanent shift, which is really interesting to us.
So let's get into those study findings at a high level. What do customers believe drive their purchase decisions, and what does the data show drives their purchase decisions?
Yeah, I think there are three lessons that are really jumping out to us from what we've seen in the data. And I think the first is, to paraphrase an idiom, that, you know, new habits die hard. What we expected to see, and I think what you've seen a lot of in the press, is this anticipation of revenge spending and that, you know, the economy is going to bounce back. And when we ask consumers in our latest leg of the Human Insights study where they intended to spend, one of the things that was quite surprising to us was that there were just as many consumers who expected to spend less after the pandemic as there were consumers who expected to spend more. Those two groups kind of cancel each other out. And when we dug a little bit deeper, what was happening there was that over half of consumers said that they were more worried and had more anxiety around things around saving and financial planning. There was actually a third of consumers who said that the number one thing that was impacted for them was their sense of financial stability. And so I think that's a really interesting dynamic for retailers to keep their eye on as things open back up. The other new habit, again, a very obvious one, would be the rise of digital. And we're particularly interested in, you know, how much of that digital behavior is likely to persist. Online grocery shopping, click and collect, for example, about a fifth of customers said that they intended to stick with that. Although, interestingly, that line is slowly starting to decline. So we're expecting to see that more consumers in the food space will be getting back into store. But broadly, you know, 35 to 45% of customers said that while they enjoyed the digital experience, the missing pieces of being able to see, touch, and trial the product were enough to drive them back into store. So as much as we've heard the noise in the media about, you know, digital adoption being driven and accelerated by 5 years over the course of 18 months, we do see some signals in the data that consumers are still hungering for a return to the physical shopping experience. The second lesson I would say is, and I think some companies have learned this quite well, consumers are looking for and will create an affinity with brands that kind of put people before the policy or process. One of the most interesting and most extreme shifts that we saw in consumer attitudes was where trust comes from. And, you know, early on in the pandemic, you know, we saw a slight lift in terms of my friends and family, I'm going to trust them more. That's now 3/4 of respondents saying that that is the primary place that they get information about what brands to transact with and what new products they should experience. Whereas the number for information from big corporations, only 4% of consumers say that they trust that information. And so for brands that, you know, maybe larger brands, that says to us, those traditional ways of talking to those consumers and pushing messaging out to them is going to be met with some real skepticism. And that leads to my third point, which is a notion of, you know, starting to leverage consumer communities versus direct one-to-one communication. A lot of focus in retail over the last little while has been on personalizing the experience, personalizing the communication, the sort of one-to-one. And what we're seeing very rich in the data is that that type of engagement is increasingly less likely to drive customer advocacy. And what's on the rise are communications around giving me the skills to make myself better, allowing me to connect with people who look like me. And so that says to us that a focus on connecting to larger groups of consumers and being helpful to enthusiast communities is really going to be a key pillar for successful brands and businesses over the course of the next, you know, year to 3 years.
That is really interesting, and a point you bring up in that all we've heard about, it seems like, over the last 5 years has been personalization and getting down to that one-to-one granular level in terms of marketing. But your findings seem to be a little bit counterintuitive, at least to that approach. What are some ways in which we've seen, in a general sense, retailers kind of change their focus and maybe get that message out there to enable customers to connect with groups or kind of self-path to their own decisions?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, one of the things we've been looking at is who's done well over the course of obviously the last 18 months, but the last 2 to 3 years in terms of leaning into this. And so I look at retailers like, for example, Lululemon and what they've been able to do with their both their local and their global ambassador program. They created a really rich community around their brand, not by saying we want to build a branded community, but by actually reaching out to the yoga community and creating space in store that was, you know, directly helpful. And in fact, you know, Lululemon was one of the few retailers that was able to expand outside of discount, that was able to expand its retail footprint over the course of the pandemic. You know, then there are other brands like, for example, Glossier, who I think have done a wonderful job of creating a digital space where enthusiasts in the beauty space can connect with one another for product recommendations, reviews, and tips and tricks on how to use the product. And that's led to, you know, incredible growth. And I came across a figure the other day that about 80% of Glossier's sales come through peer-to-peer recommendations or through their own channels. And so that speaks to the power of being able to provide a space and a platform for consumers to connect with one another. And it's a shift from, I'm trying to sell you something, I'm trying to push something to you, I'm trying to get you to buy more and engage more with me specifically as a brand, to, we understand you as a consumer, we understand the people that you're trying to connect with, we understand what you're trying to accomplish, and we're just going to be helpful. And the more that we do that, the more that you'll naturally transact with us because you're in our spaces, whether physically or digitally. And so it's a subtle shift, but I think it's a really important one as businesses think about how to communicate and drive engagement with consumers.
Another finding regarding that survey was about the increase in customers feeling that companies should be held accountable for their actions, or at least the increase in importance to them that companies should be held accountable for their actions. And we see nowadays, it seems like the social media backlash is every day towards a different company. But again, what are consumers telling us just about the values of the companies themselves and how important that is?
Yeah, we asked consumers what was most likely to impact their decision to transact with a company. And again, a little bit of a surprise to us that the three things that floated to the top of the list were, I believe that the business is going to support those in need in my community. The second was, I'm going to support businesses that support employee well-being. And then the third was, I'm going to support businesses that help me with my own health and well-being. And as you say, that's a bit of a shift in terms of the level of accountability that consumers are looking to brands to display. I think there's a little bit of a trap in there for businesses, though, which is I think that consumers have a pretty good BS detector for when it is just, words for the sake of words or following a trend, which is to take nothing away from some of the good efforts that a lot of brands have put into it. But I think that the brands that are able to do this most powerfully and really stand for something are the brands that do it in a way that is authentic to what they're trying to cause in the world with their business writ large anyway. And so a lot of the businesses we're talking to in terms of, for example, you want to support those in need in my community, it's that old canard of localizing, right? And being relevant in the local community. And, it sounds easy to do on paper. It's very hard to do, but that whole attitude towards, we're not a large chain or we're not just a large chain. We're able to tailor in the store itself is a presence in a community that is staffed by local people, and those local people have relationships with local consumers. That kind of turning the knob up on that, I think, was a very genuine and authentic way for brands to lean into contributing to those in need in the community and showcasing what they stand for in an authentic and maybe slightly less just symbolic way. I think, to really boil this up, I'm going to repeat the point that I think consumers have a high BS detector and that it needs to be material, not just symbolic.
One of the things you mentioned earlier in discussing some of the more recent survey findings is the fact that we're seeing customers hunger a little bit more for getting back to brick and mortar, whether that be in grocery, whether that be in other retail areas. Based on not only the survey findings, but your other work outside of that with retailers, what types of retailers do you think have maybe the longest road set out for them as far as winning some of this very willing brick and mortar traffic back through their doors?
Yeah, this was an interesting finding for us too. And I should preface all of this by saying, and maybe this is a very obvious point, but I don't think there's a world in which any retailer can get away with not having both a great, physical and digital experience writ large. Unless you're an Amazon, and I was noting in the news today that Amazon just overtook Walmart as the largest Western retailer in the world. Unless you're sitting there, it's pretty tough to make a permanent play that is just digital. But when we looked at specific spaces and asked consumers about their intent to return to the in-store experience, spaces like grocery, dining, pet care, home improvement, those were all spaces that saw a modest uptick in terms of consumers saying, when the world opens back up again, I'm going to be back in store. And I think that makes sense, particularly the grocery one makes a lot of sense to me. But the areas where there was more reticence to return, or perhaps more just comfort with the pure digital experience, home decor, grooming and beauty, and then the biggest surprise for us was in the world of clothing and apparel. And this is one that we're still trying to, really understand because on the one hand, we've got a data point that says the consumers are driven to get back in store because they want to touch, feel, and trial the product. On the other hand, we see that, clothing and apparel is one of the spaces where consumers don't want to get in, and yet it's such a high touch, high experience. You got to try on the pants before you buy them. And I think what's maybe happening there is that consumers have, and actually, fair credit to the retailers where it's due, they've created a digital experience with, fast shipping, cheap and easy returns that is actually allowing people to order a lot, try all of it on at home, and then return it, that is actually proving to be a little bit better than the in-store experience. That's my hypothesis. I don't think we see that fully justified in the data. But I think largely, what we're looking for in this is any category in which there's not an immediate, high experiential element to the product where I can make a decision without getting my hands on it. That's just going to be a pretty high bar for any retailer to entice consumers back into store.
We've referenced this before in this conversation, but I think especially surveying the type of work that Jackman does and certain case studies, if you will, of Jackman's work throughout the retail industry, I did want to ask you about this. We've talked about all of this data to this point, and I'm just kind of curious if you can give us an example of how Jackman might use this data to maybe redefine the type of customer or the type of customers that a retailer might want to bring through their doors or kind of change that corporate mindset about their marketing in that way.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that question because up until this point in the conversation, we've been talking about consumers as though they're a monolith. In the Human Insights Study, in fact, we've teased consumers apart into eight different segments or archetypes. And that's the work that we always do with our retail partners at the outset of a project. We don't just, apply the standard eight that we've defined through this study. We actually do a bespoke attitudinal study and then are able to create bespoke profiles of different customers who are driven by different attitudes and therefore manifesting different behaviors. And the reason that that's important is strictly because strategy is about choices. And I don't mean that just in a, hey, we have to figure out what to do, but you also have to have a clear story that you're able to tell customers about why come to us. And you can't tell that story unless you're able to speak into the attitudes that are going to drive and motivate them. So at the outset of all of our work, we actually go through a facilitated exercise with the leadership that we work with at each of our partners to do a prioritization exercise. And it's always one single customer segment at the top of the pile. Now, we understand that you're going to design an experience that's not going to turn anyone away, but having that clarity of these consumers who are driven by these specific attitudes, they're really motivating them. If we can get tight on that, then it's really easy for us to say, well, therefore, if we do these things, if that customer knows about us, they will always come to us. So, for example, in the context of some of the work that we did with Staples, one of our unlocks was in identifying a customer segment that was really motivated by their own internal improvement, working and learning. And so we were able to create an entire strategy that was tailored towards that customer. Now, whether that customer happened to be young, old, an entrepreneur, a teacher, a student, there's tactics that you can do that will manifest differently for those groups, but the spirit and the attitude and how the brand shows up and how the store is designed speaks into we're going to get you on that road to working and learning. Similarly with Joann Fabrics in the States, they sort of had showed up as a, a warehouse of crafting stuff. But through our research, we were able to identify a segment who was really motivated by the art of crafting in order to share with other people. It's a highly social segment. And so in the work that we did with the Joann team, we were able to redesign the store so there were more deliberate spaces in store to entice crafting groups and school groups, church groups, quilting groups into the store and make that a useful space. And we took merchandise off the floor and actually saw an uptick in sales, which, is kind of counterintuitive to anyone who's grown up in a merchandising organization. But that's the type of unlock that can come through getting really crisp and tight on what are the potential roads we could go down and consumer attitudes we can target, and then which one are we just going to pick and put at the top of the pile to guide all of our decision making and choice. It's a very hard exercise. It requires a lot of discipline. The natural human instinct is to say, well, yes, but let's also add in these people and add in this and add in this until it's, a Frankenstein segment. But if you get it right, the rewards themselves are very, very rich. And I just add to all of that that, there's a tendency in strategy work to treat it as a very tactical exercise. It's in the data, it's in the numbers. We'll get to the right answer. But by starting with insight into real humans and the way that real humans think and how that drives their behavior, you create a thread that runs through the entirety of the strategic process, the planning process, and the activation that actually motivates humans to want to make this change happen and is easy to communicate to humans on the back end so they get what you're doing. And I think that's the secret sauce to our success is the balancing of the technical exercise of strategy with the very human exercise of making change happen.
Some really great examples of all this data being put into action. If I can, I would like to close with this question. I know it's kind of a broader question here, but as you look out at the retail landscape, what is one area you feel like retailers might be missing on, or maybe don't really understand or don't connect with their consumers regarding just understanding the human element? If you could just look at the entirety of retail and maybe come away with one thing retailers need to do better, what would it be?
Yeah, it's painting with a broad brush, and there are some retailers who have this figured out way better than I will, but there are, I'd say, the vast majority of retailers that we deal with, where they get stuck is in dealing with and sort of treating as the priority all of the internal nuts and bolts, getting the digital capabilities online, making sure that the store operations are smooth. And all of that's fantastic. You have to do it. It is table stakes stuff. But if that's happening at the expense of also being crystal clear on how you're going to drive deeper engagement with consumers that have this, you know, type of attitude, and we're crystal clear on who we're for and who we're not for, if you don't have that vision, all of the rest is kind of noise. It doesn't even really show up to the consumer. It doesn't give them a reason to come to you. You know, not having it will give them a reason not to come to you, but you're missing the second element, which is you also need a positive reason for them to come to you. And I think particularly what we're seeing, and again, completely understandable, the world has moved on very quickly. The table stakes have risen. You need to, you know, be able to offer swift delivery. You need to have very good inventory management that's flowing through your online stores, et cetera, et cetera. All of that, you know, I get why that is a massive area of focus for businesses, and particularly right now. But I would say the trick that is being missed is, look, as we're coming out of this pandemic, consumers have really moved on in terms of what they're looking for, in terms of connecting with a brand and becoming advocates for the brand. And if you're not doing that work as well and in parallel, I think there's a very good chance that somebody's going to come along and eat your lunch. So, you know, short answer, in addition to focusing on the table stakes, figure out and really focus on where is your consumer gone? How have they changed? And therefore, how do we need to change to follow them to drive outsized engagement and a much better experience?
Some really phenomenal insight, and I've enjoyed this opportunity to talk with you today about the more emotional side, if you will, of customer engagement. Well, Stefan, I appreciate you taking the time, and it's been fantastic having you on today.
Hey, thank you so much. It was an absolute pleasure to be here.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, thanks, Stefan, for joining us. And once again, lots of great insights from Jackman. I think it's so interesting because we spend so much time talking about data on the show, as I said to the introduction of that interview, and yet so little data gets down to what is actually driving consumer decisions. We know what consumer decisions are. We know anticipated sales numbers, but it's about the emotions oftentimes behind those decisions. And I think Jackman's doing some great work. The human behavior part of retail is something that has always fascinated me. And so we certainly thank him for shining some light on that portion of retail. Now, our looking ahead story, I do want to glance at the two home improvement titans whose earnings calls took place this past week. At Lowe's, comps did decline 2.2% in the U.S., which, given the circumstances and all the stuff we've talked about lapping solid quarters from last year, they were pretty pleased with. Home Depot, however, continued positive momentum with comps up 3.4% in the U.S. Basically, it was like a typical pre-COVID quarter for them. 15 of their 19 regions in the U.S., by the way, were positive. But the reason I'm looking ahead to things is big ticket growth. Lowe's saw 17% growth in tickets over $500 during this past quarter. For Home Depot, big ticket transactions were up 24%. For them, big ticket transactions are those over $1,000. I think this is a worthy story looking ahead because of a couple of different things. One is this tells you that customers are trading up in terms of appliances, in terms of home installations, whether that be bathroom or kitchen. Both categories did pretty well for both retailers in this case. And Home Depot, in fact, Craig Menear, their CEO, said on the call specifically that they're seeing customers trading up to newer home appliances, whether that be because of design, whether that be because of functionality. They're also seeing trading up in terms of the next generation of electronic yard equipment, whether that be mowers or trimmers. Will we continue to see the big ticket items flow off the shelves over the next 6 months? Because again, you look at the first 6 months of the year, you had another round of stimulus payments, people getting back to work, you had this inflow of funds from the economy. But again, looking back to what Stefan Reed said, is there's this idea that we're going to see revenge spending and people are going to really get out and spend money. And that seems to be the case at least so far for big appliances. But how much of it is the fact that the pandemic appeared to be on the verge of ending a few months ago, at least? And how much of it is the idea that the stimulus payments were helping out and customers had this extra money on their hands to be able to upgrade, some of those appliances that they realized during the pandemic they used so much? And how much will the nesting phenomenon continue? We talked about furniture sales being solid at Sam's Club at the beginning of the show. I think these are all worthy questions to ask. Well, Lowe's, for one, is pretty certain that they're going to see continued momentum in appliances because they're actually changing their delivery model. Rather than fulfilling from the stores, keeping inventory at the store level, they're moving to a market-based delivery model for large appliances. This started during the last quarter in Florida. The idea was to cut down the lead times that customers could expect to receive an appliance. And then also, basically, they're using market-based fulfillment. So rather than fulfilling from the individual stores, there's a fulfillment center that is used to deliver these appliances to customers. So far, at least in their test markets, it's led to increased sell-through for appliances, but also less inventory on hand. I think this is an interesting idea, but Lowe's planning to roll this out to the rest of the country over the next few years. They want several more markets by year's end. So this tells you that Marvin Ellison and company think appliance sales will continue with strength. But I think it's a category that is worth keeping a close eye on because it has been driving sales for Home Depot and Lowe's. One other kind of side looking ahead is, of course, the issue with lumber, where we've seen massive deflation in terms of lumber. Per 1,000 board feet, you were looking at prices at one point earlier this year, over $1,500. Now, at some points this year, you've seen around $500. So massive fluctuation in terms of lumber prices out there. And you also wonder how that will affect retailers' top and bottom line. But I think the appliance story is a little bit more indicative of where U.S. consumers feel their wallets sit currently and where they feel their financial flexibility sits currently. That, of course, happens before we even get into the idea that maybe they're using credit for these purchases and maybe that could come calling in the next couple of years and could have a longer impact. Now, I just want to look ahead to the next 6 months or so. Will appliance sales continue? To that end, while we're talking about it, next week we'll be discussing kitchen appliances specifically with Mary Rogers of Cuisinart. She's going to talk a little bit about their cadence of holiday sales, how it differs from other retailers, and how that informs their marketing approach. And it seems like Cuisinart is shaping up for what would be a pretty optimistic last half of the year in terms of those kitchen appliance sales. So just something to keep in mind as well there. Well, once again, we thank Stefan Reed for joining us. We thank Leighton behind the scenes. And we also want to thank our show partner, Quantum Metric. Once again, you can visit them at quantummetric.com/podoffer. Use the code RETAILFOCUS to see if you're eligible for their 12 Days of Insights offer. Talked about the interview coming up next week, and I look forward to meeting you again 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.